In the call to worship, I briefly spoke of Sankofa, the tradition of the Akan people to look back into our history and to look within our hearts to better inform our present and our future. There was a picture of a heart with a concentric circle representing the search within, and a picture of a mythical bird that shows an egg in its beak as a treasure found. It depicts the story and is a reflection of the cycle of life, death, and resurrection. Long before the Declaration of Independence was drafted, the seeds of American pluralism were scattered across this land. We must acknowledge that this soil was already rich with complex indigenous traditions of coexistence and spiritual stewardship long before the European settlers arrived. I recently encountered this deep indigenous history when I returned from Minneapolis just this past week. I visited the sacred site of Bedote, the confluence of the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers. According to the Minnesota Historical Society, it's a place where the Dakota people and rivers have been meeting for at least 10,000 years. In the Dakota's sacred creation story, their people came from what the ancient Greeks and we call Orion's Belt and arrived in Bedote. It is their Eden. While Bedote is the origin story and location for the Dakota, it is also the location of their forced exile and the concentration camps at Fort Snelling, built by the U.S. Army. Our history is complex, complicated, and nuanced. The Dakota are just one of thousands of tribes, including the Manahoic. They lived there well before America started its birth. Many of those tribes no longer exist. In place is an imperfect nation that continues on. Today is an opportunity to reflect on our past, knowing that it is much deeper and much, much older than 250 years. It is important to note that religious tolerance and pluralism did not arrive fully formed from our European settlers. We remember the British clergyman Roger Williams, banished into the cold wilderness of Massachusetts in 1635. Simply for his convictions, he found a home when he started the Providence Plantation in Rhode Island, initiating what he called a lively experiment, a community grounded in full liberty in religious concernments. Williams institutionalized soul liberty. He created a sanctuary where dissenters could breathe. He furthered the radical idea that the state has no right to police the human conscience. It was out of Rhode Island soil that an open-mindedness and this new, beautiful idea began to bloom: American pluralism and the separation of church and state. Leading up to the Declaration of Independence, the world seemed to be turning upside down. The battles of Lexington and Concord had ignited the war, and the newly formed Rhode Island Brigade was stationed outside Boston. These volunteers came from different colonies, different churches, and looked upon one another's theological dogmas with suspicion. Colonel James Mitchell Varnum, commanding the 2nd Rhode Island Regiment, knew his men were stepping into the shadow of potential sudden death and trauma of war. He also knew John Murray. They were friends. He knew John was an eloquent preacher whose message of universal salvation completely rejected the dominant Calvinist dread of hellfire, brimstone, and predestination. Murray preached that a creator of infinite wisdom and benevolence would ultimately save every human soul. Now, to the conservative elite, this was a dangerous heresy, and it surely would breed anarchy and lawlessness. If there was no hell, they argued, why would people follow orders? Why would they obey rules, whether that of the military, the state, or God? If they wouldn't, would they just be punished? Is that all the consequence was? But two Rhode Islanders, Colonel Varnum and General Nathaniel Greene, steeped in Roger Williams' legacy, saw their troops did not need to be weaponized by fear of damnation. They needed the armor of hope. Varnum begged Murray to join them as chaplain of the Rhode Island Brigade in the Continental Army. Murray accepted. He reported to the army camps and into the open air pulpits of the defensive positions at Jamaica Hill and Prospect Hill, overlooking the British in Boston. The conservative establishment did not take this lightly. In September of 1775, as we heard with A Time for All Ages, six powerful Calvinist army chaplains took the highly uncharacteristic step of completely bypassing the chain of command in the military. They petitioned General George Washington directly. They claimed Murray's principles were highly pernicious and that his presence would be exceedingly hurtful to the army. It would introduce disorder and confusion among the troops. They demanded Murray's immediate removal. It was as if they were trying to erase a group of people who were different, as if they didn't truly exist. Sound familiar? They wanted theological uniformity, but General Washington was a supreme pragmatist and idealist. He looked at the army, saw that it was desperately short on chaplains. He looked at the Rhode Island troops, who fiercely loved Murray and refused to accept anyone else. So on September 10, 1775, General Greene hosted a dinner at the headquarters in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sitting at the table were Greene, Varnum, Murray, and George Washington himself. They looked past doctrinal divisions and focused on character, merit, and the common cause. 1 week later, on September 17, 1775, Washington issued his general orders. He completely overruled the conservative ministers. He formally appointed John Murray, firmly commanding that he be respected as such. This was the first institutional victory for theological pluralism in American history. Washington established a monumental precedent. In the American experiment, practical unity and individual merit would outweigh theological conformity. The government could employ and respect clergy without demanding a single state-approved creed. Now, what did John Murray do with this victory? He didn't use it to force others to convert to universalism. Instead, he practiced a deliberate and inclusive liturgy tailored for a pluralist army. Preaching to soldiers in his formation, Baptists, Anglicans, Congregationalists, and non-believers alike, he turned to the words of Psalm 44. In the morning he would read, "We have heard with our ears, O God, the nation thou hast planted." He assured every weary soldier that regardless of their colony or creed, that they were interconnected in a divine providence that belonged to them all collectively. In the evening, he would close again with Psalm 44, "Arise for our help and redeem us for thy mercy's sake. This was a theology that required no limited atonement. It was battlefield therapy. The Calvinist chaplains had warned that Murray's message would cause moral decay, but the opposite occurred. The rank and file responded with cohesion, attendance swelled, and Murray proudly noted that profanity drastically decreased, at least within his earshot. We are the spiritual inheritors of that muddy campsite in Boston. The U.S. Army Chaplain Corps today operates under a beautiful motto: nurture the living, care for the wounded, honor the fallen. That motto unknowingly echoes John Murray's universalist promise that no soul is left behind and no one is beyond redemption. Today, the ranks of our military chaplains include not just Protestants, but Unitarian Universalists, Catholics, Jews, Buddhists, Muslims, humanists, Wiccans, and many others. It is those military chaplains that continue to support our troops and their families. John Murray's service in the Continental Army as the first Universalist chaplain in 1775 lasted only 8 months. He was forced to resign from his position after suffering from severe illness with bilious fever. But Murray's legacy did not end with his time in the Continental Army. Just a few years later, in Gloucester, Massachusetts, John Murray became the minister of the very first organized Universalist Church in America in 1779. At that time, Congregationalism, what today we know as Puritanism, was the official religion in Gloucester. As a result, all churchgoers of the town were expected to pay pew taxes, and those had to go to the first parish church of Gloucester. However, Reverend John Murray and several members of the First Universalist Church defied in resistance. Instead, they chose to pay their taxes to their own Universalist Church. As you can imagine, this caused quite a stir. By 1786, this resistance movement made it to the Massachusetts Supreme Court. In the long-contested case of John Murray versus the inhabitants of the First Parish of Gloucester, the court found in favor of the Universalists. This was a landmark case of legal precedent for the separation of church and state. Living to the wise age of 73, John Murray traveled the United States preaching universal salvation and eventually becoming known as one of the founders of American Universalism. That space that John Murray carved out in the 18th century has never been surrendered. It became the basis leading to religious clauses for the First Amendment. Later, it expanded into the core values and principles of our faith: pluralism, justice, equity, and the respect and dignity of every human. It is the heartbeat for the long-held aphorism widely attributed to the founder of Methodism, John Wesley, and oftentimes misattributed to the 16th century Transylvanian Unitarian Francis David, that we need not think alike to love alike. We live out these principles and values as a living tradition of wisdom and spirituality, drawing from sources as diverse as scripture, poetry, science, and personal experience. We should remember that 250 years ago, freedom and independence was not declared for all, certainly not indigenous people, not women, not slaves, among many others. I would like to begin to close with the words from Matthew McConaughey's book, Green Lights, where he reflects on Langston Hughes, who wrote about America as a land that has never been yet. America is a land that, like any individual with ambition and will to improve, to better themselves and to succeed, will never arrive. Always on our way, America is a dream that is constantly updated, yet never realized, a place that will never be yet. The hero we chase, America, is the heavenly place we seek. Our transcendent and better selves that we never catch, where we improve and will be our best, never, because we have the courage to continue the pursuit. America is where we fight for equal opportunity and never fully acquire it, where we seek justice and we will never meet its measure, where we pursue righteousness and will still be wrong. The mountaintop we will never crest, yet we continue to climb to the place we have to, and never will attain the unattainable dream, that the land of opportunity. So we must chase it. That's America. As Americans in America, we must be dreamers in our land of dreams. Never satisfied of the marathon that has no finish line, with an unquenchable thirst, believing in and forever chasing ideals which we will never fully attain. United in ascension as a nation and a people who refuse to stop growing. This is the American dream, our country's promise, eternally unfulfilled, permanently in process, staying in the race, committed to the chase, now and forever yet. All right, all right, all right. He didn't say that. I mean, he said that. America at 250 is still, in the prescient words of Roger Williams, a lively experiment. It is still imperfect, it is still being informed, and yet still tested by the voices of intolerance. But as we look to the next 250 years, let us carry Murray's map of hope. Let us remember that our strength lies not in the theological or ideological uniformity, but in our brave embrace of love for all. May we continue to form a faith, a nation, and a world where love is universal. Freedom of conscience is absolute, and every single soul is respected as such.